At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement, the podcast. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. All right. So without further ado, this has been an interview that has been a long time coming. It feels like a long time because scheduling and everything going on right now, it wasn't in the cards. But now it is, and I'm excited. You know, Jody Neal, welcome to the podcast. So I am so grateful for you, for your energy, and bringing your whole self to the work that you do. And just, I'm in awe. I'm so excited.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. You're doing very important work too. Feels like we're finally getting some traction, in the conversation, thanks to people like you who are so bravely taking this content to the masses.
You know, I've always been told that if you see something, say something and be the change, be the voice, and always advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves, because that retaliation piece is something that is not really talked about nearly enough at all, because those retaliatory, you know, if a survivor comes forward, you know, and if they, especially against somebody that's deemed, you know, quote unquote, and has notoriety or some type of like power, you know, like what do we see right now? We see Jeffrey Epstein, right? Yeah. We're seeing that a lot. And I've talked about it numerous times in this podcast, and we'll talk about it too. But anyway, let's dive in, and, you know, feel free to introduce yourself to our audience and to our listeners, and, you know, walk us through a bit about your journey. The floor is yours.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Jody Neal. I am a second generation lawyer, trial lawyer, who has practiced in both the criminal and civil sectors, primarily in the field of survivors. I was assigned to the Crimes Against Children Division in my 20s, and then most recently served as chief of the Crimes Against Children Division. So twice I've done these crimes, done the criminal system. And then in the meantime, I spent several years consulting to NGOs in Southeast Asia when I had my two daughters over there. And then I came back and I did civil litigation, largely the opioid litigation, but I also worked with survivors on the side. And I have a book coming out called Outcry Witness. It is a former prosecutor's guide to healing and justice after sexual violence. This book is actually my outcry. It is the first time that I told the truth about what had happened to me, specifically three formative events that I could remember. And I, it's the book that I wish had existed when I was trying to outcry many times over the years. So I had to write it. And my publisher is my outcry witness. And it has been a wild journey. And I am looking forward to getting this out into the public sphere. It just went up on Amazon the other day, on Saturday, and then it'll be available in hands by April 7th.
It's not very often that I lose words on how I want to describe something. You know, whenever we announced that we were going to do a podcast, okay, and we received 300 messages almost instantaneously, because, you know, having 200,000 followers, obviously we get hundreds, if not thousands of messages every single week. There was one message that came across, and that was from you. And you're like, hey, here's something that I can talk about. You know, here's a little bit about my background. Here's my website. And I'm sitting here thinking like, okay. I was like, and I just had like this like look on my face, and I was like, this is going to be a good one. Then we sat down and did your pre-interview, and learning about your experiences and learning about you know, your story, but also what kind of led you into doing this work. And we'll dive into that here in just a minute. But I just have to say, like, I'm at a loss of words, because I think this is such a powerful testimony to why every voice matters in the movement to eradicate sexual and gender-based violence, and why it's so incredibly important to make sure that all perspectives are represented in these spaces. And, you know, talking to survivors, talking to organizations, talking to leaders, it's all valid. But I do feel that there are certain perspectives that oftentimes are left out. And that comes from the judges. That also comes from the attorneys, the lawyers. And, you know, I can't imagine what you've seen over the years. And I mentioned about growing up in Missouri. And the county that I grew up in is now moving the most serious offenses in regards to like domestic violence and like sexual assault and et cetera. They're moving it to from a municipal court to a county court. I'm excited to see that, because they're taking survivors' testimonies more serious. And this is a brand new prosecuting attorney that just, you know, began her job in January of this year. And there was a lot of questions that, okay, she doesn't have any trial experience. She doesn't have this. She doesn't have that. Look at what she's doing. She's taken something that has historically failed survivors and kind of like gave a slap on the wrist to, you know, perpetrators, right? And now taking it more serious, bringing it to a higher court, and is prosecuting it as such. It's showing that that dynamic and that needle is, you know, shifting and it's changing. Times are changing, and believing survivors is also coming to the forefront. So, but anyway, enough about, you know, hearing my voice. Let's jump into yours. So what led you to becoming, you know, an advocate for survivors, an advocate for children? And what led you into practicing law? You know, what was that journey like for you?
Great question. I knew when I was very young that I wanted to be a courtroom lawyer. That's what my dad did. And I don't remember anyone ever telling me that I had to, but I knew I was going to, starting when I was about five. And so that really helped me narrow down the process of getting through school, because I didn't really have to worry about making great grades, because DA's offices are more interested in your communication skills. And, you know, really, are you comfortable around people? Are you comfortable speaking? So I was able to get through school pretty quickly. And I went to the DA's office right out of law school. I was a rabid trial lawyer. I had a lot to prove. I had big shoes to fill. And I was in a competition with my dad. And so I just tried as many cases as there were. You know, I was taking files from other prosecutors. I tried so many cases. And eventually, they assigned me. I did a tour in the White Collar Crimes Division, and I'd been in there for maybe a month or two. And the acting chief of CAC and the investigator came into my office, and they said, "Hey, we want you in crimes against children." And I remember sitting there just like my life flashed before my eyes, because I had had some childhood trauma. You know, I hadn't dug into it yet, but I knew that I didn't really want to do that job. Like, enough at that. And I had been a survivor, you know, when I was 19-ish. So between those two things, I knew it was very risky for me, but I wasn't going to say no, because I was a soldier. And I wasn't going to show weakness by refusing the assignment, because, you know, I was in a competition with my dad. So we went to the first assistant's office, and he said, "All right, well, we're going to assign you to CAC. You know, it's a very elite division. Whatever in the county where I was, whatever resources the division needed, they tended to get." And, you know, it was like, "Show me what you can do. And, you know, maybe I'll put you, you know, on a murder team or a capital murder team." And so I got in there and just started at it. The first month I cried every night. I cried every night for a month. But that's how I ended up. And then, you know, and it just went on from there. And it became really like a disassociative, you know, practice, because I was a victim, but I hadn't admitted it to myself. But I was working with all these survivors, and I was learning, I was being trained by the advocacy center, the Children's Advocacy Center, my chief. And so I was learning all the stuff. I mean, all of the professional things I needed to know, victim behaviors, perpetrator behaviors. And so it was all starting to come together, but I still hadn't said it to myself, but I needed to say the things to the kids. And so on the one hand, I developed this very deep consciousness of, you know, empathy to speak to the, especially the child survivors. Like, you are so brave. You only have one job, and that's to tell the truth. You can do this. I'll be with you. And on the other hand, I basically had like a split life. I hadn't said it myself yet to myself.
And, you know, sitting down and reading like your biography, 2 decades, okay, 20 years. That's a really long time to be around and exposed to trauma and the different experiences that you have heard, that you have seen. You know, it doesn't go unnoticed. And I know that you have helped hundreds, if not thousands, of people gain justice. And if they didn't get justice, I know that you fought. If there's anything about you, I say you are an absolute fighter. And I acknowledge that. And I want to be sure that others see that as well.
Thank you.
And I want to make sure that people know how the complexity of this job and all facets that go into it, because it is not just one size fits all. This is not for every single person. This is something that you have to literally have the passion to help others. You have to be committed to it, because you are going to see some very tough things.
Yeah.
And your courage and your strength is beyond immeasurable. And I want to be sure that you understand that. And I know you understand, but I want to make sure others understand this different perspective of and different side of this, you know, this advocacy work that oftentimes gets overlooked. So writing this book, okay, The Outcry Witness, that's a different side of like your own personal advocacy that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of, you know, mental capacity. It takes a lot to focus on. What has been this journey look like? What has this journey looked like for you in writing this book, you know, working with publishers? That could be daunting as it is, but what's your experience? What's it been like for you?
Man, well, I discovered in one of my journals from 2006, I wrote, and this was after I'd already, you know, pitched the topic, got the publisher, hired the collaborator. Oh, I should write Outcry Witness. That'd be a great name for a book. I am so grateful that no one got to it before I did. You know, I thank the good Lord every day that I get to use this. It's a term of art. It's a hearsay exception in Texas. And so it's been a 20-year journey, but I couldn't write it because I wasn't ready. And it was truly the monster under the bed. My own is really the fear of saying the truth about what had happened to me that kept me paralyzed and frozen. And so, you know, I pitched this topic to the publishers, the first publisher I ever contacted. They, you know, they were my actual outcry witness, the first people that I told. And then they went with me through the process of finding, I don't even want to call her a ghostwriter. She's a collaborator, but I had to have one. I had to have one with all of this, you know, going through the journals, especially. Walking through the fire. It was just walking through the fire. It was the most, you know, I don't want to make it sound too bad because I don't want people to not outcry, you know, but it was a big deal. But I will say that once I got past the fear of it, the rest of it was downhill. It was the first step, which we always know is the hardest, really was the hardest in this. And I didn't realize until it was after I'd already started the book that I found Bessel van der Kolk, Body Keeps the Score, that everything I knew from my own life and from working with survivors is actually supported by science. Like, I thought it was just me that was frozen. And like, I could not say all of this out loud, but it turns out it's a physical phenomenon. Your brain is reorganized when you go through trauma like this. The trauma is what remains when you survive crimes. And you really become frozen. Like, it's not just a Jody Neal thing. It's like a survivor of violence thing. But it can be beat. And you know what he says is the thing that beats it is saying that it happened to you. So he confirmed a major, like the hallmark of my book. And then 2, to say it to someone else who holds space for you and is your witness. So that's 2. So as I was working with my collaborator, you know, I just kept getting very strong messages that I was doing the right thing. I went back to the DA's office to be chief of crimes against children. It was not a good situation for a lot of reasons that I can talk about some other time. But what it did teach me, it reorganized the book for me, because I was still believed that the criminal system was like the way to heal. Like, oh, if we can just get more people into the criminal system, because I'd seen real healing and real justice. Like, I'd seen it for real, and it can happen. But when I went back this last time, it broke me, because it was like the last piece of the system that I could believe in had crumbled. And I was a part of a 9-year-old criminal case involving two girls who were trafficked to a bad guy who, since we talked, took his own life in his lawyer's office on his plea day. So, you know, it was really a dangerous situation. Anyways, you know, that 9-year-old case, I couldn't get it to trial, and I couldn't shake it. And I said, there's got to be another way, because I cannot send. You know, I already had the book underway. I can't send millions of people this route. And so I had to completely, you know, reformulate the strategy, and came to land on, look, if you're an adult, you know, there are a lot of different ways that you can have your healing moment, which is saying the truth to another person. And it's not run into the police station. You know, your healing is yours. What happens on that is a different, you know, that's further down the line. But first, you got to take the first steps, because it's keeping you from living your life. And so, you know, so I left the DA's office and focused on this book, and I got the manuscript submitted in June. Yeah.
Which is incredible, you know, and that's a long time to be working on something. That's something that is not, and it's not the easiest thing to just put everything out there. It's like, what, this is, you know, what happened. This is what this looks like. This is what this is. This is what this is. And you mentioned something just a second ago, and like just running to the police station, right? Now, I grew up watching Special Victims. You know, Mariska Hargitay is one of my favorite actresses. She always will be.
I would love to read my book to her. If she's listening, please read my book.
Let's manifest it. You know, let's make it happen. Because, you know, she plays a cop on TV, but in real life, she is a legit advocate for survivors. Like, not just in her role on a television show, but, you know, being the founder of the Joyful Heart Foundation. And, you know, they have done some very impactful work at ending the rape kit backlog. You know, they're a big voice in the backlog, and she is just a badass human being. And, you know, I watched the documentary that she talked about her mother, and I cried from the beginning to the end. Not just because she was my first, like, celebrity crush, because she was, because she's beautiful, she's gorgeous, she's, you know, anyway. I'm going to continue gushing, but no, she is just an overall badass human being that I've always looked up to, but they make it look incredibly easy to just walk in and say, hey, I, you know, this happened to me, and they take you into this room, and they, you know, they question you, and you go through the trial, and they make it look super, super easy, but it paints a false narrative, and it paints a false image that it always looks like that. Now, don't get me wrong, there are cases that, you know, it's very easy to do, but there's still a lot that goes into that. In actuality, it's really not easy. Because they're still, you know, having to face your perpetrator, having to explain your story numerous times to police, to the prosecutor, to, you know, to the nurse examiner. If you get to that point, keyword is if you get to that point, because we know that the system is far from working in everybody's favor. But, you know, let's kind of dive in a little bit and talk about some of the pieces, not necessarily that you, I know there's like a fine line of what you can actually talk about, what you can't talk about, and et cetera, but let's think about some of those pieces that you have read up on, or you want to talk about, or can talk about. Let's kind of dive into a little bit of those.
Okay.
So cases are incredibly complex. The criminal justice system is incredibly complex. And so is the healing journey for survivors, because we know it's not linear. We know that it's very complex and it's very spread out. And oftentimes, you know, especially like for myself, healing is not a destination. I just want to continue growing.
Yeah.
And continue growing into the person that my mom, you know, always said I was going to be. Yeah. She's like, you're going to be a leader. You're going to be an advocate. She was right. But am I everybody's cup of tea? No. And if you look at the way I run our social media with the movement, you'll find out that I call things out left and right, because this isn't just this isn't a Republican issue. This isn't a Democrat issue. This is literally, we're talking about human lives here.
Yeah.
Y'all, I want to make sure that people understand that. Now, do I find it easier to work with certain like elected officials than I do others? Absolutely. But I also want to be frank and say that even then, there's still a lot of flaws because they do not pay attention and they do not listen to that survivor voice.
Yeah.
I mean, look at how long it took to get a vote to release the Jeffrey Epstein files. Look how long it is. And that's a bipartisan issue. They did work bipartisanly. I am really glad it did pass. But there's a lot more that needs to continue happening because this, even with those files being released, there's still generations of people like who failed. And one thing to recognize is these women and men that did come forward, because there's over 1,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to recognize is they were children.
Yeah.
They were children. When they were trafficked, they were abused. They were children. You know, rest in power, Virginia. That's I'm going to leave it at that. But let's dive into some of the cases that you've either worked or that you know about. And some of those cases are worse than others. And this isn't to kind of like downplay another case, but there are some that are take a lot more investigating and a lot more energy to understand what's truly happening. So think about a case that kind of took you back and made you think about, why did I ever do this? Why did I ever start this? Think about that case.
I'm going to go back to my 9-year-old case. You know, there were two girls that had been, you know, and this one actually was trafficking, you know, and their voices they've never been heard. You know, 9 years, the defendant got 14 continuances. You know, he's living his best life, taking cross-country road trips, you know, on bond. And these girls, you know, one of them couldn't even do EMDR, you know, because she was going to have to testify. You know, you want that raw, you want that raw remembrance, because that is the emotional evidence that the jury needs to know. And, you know, they need their stomach to drop and know that what this person lived was real. And so, you know, that just like it was like I could feel their bondage. They were just in a cage. You know, and they couldn't get out until this case was, you know, tried. And, you know, anyone who's survived what they've survived would have some accompanying, you know, treatment issues or, you know, behaviors. And seeing all of that weaponized against, you know, one of the daughters. And then, you know, just really, really the time it took, it was really a crime upon humanity. And there was nothing I could do to get the case tried. I mean, I threw my eyeglasses down in the courtroom. I stomped my foot. You know, I did everything I could, and I couldn't. And it was really just a feeling of powerlessness that was unacceptable to me. And, you know, when we feel really powerless, when you know you're powerless, there's really only one place to take it, which is to the streets, you know? Take it to the streets. Like you, every day in your podcast, you see stuff and it just makes you sick to your stomach and you get so mad. And so you just have to channel it into something productive. And so I talk about these girls in my book at a few different times. And of course, I have the permission to do it. And I fully plan on telling their story. You know, I fully plan on sitting down with them so that they can finally have that moment of being witnessed. And what I have seen, so the jury trial process, like we've got to make this more available, because when it works and when everyone does their jobs and follows the rules, it is a sacred experience, because there you have 12 people who are listening to the same thing at the same time, noticing the same or different stuff, but it's all happening in real time. There's a judge, there's bailiff, there's a court reporter. Like, it is actual facts. You can't fake news it. It can't be manipulated. It is a portal of truth when it's done right and when you can get there. And that's the problem, is we can't get there. And sometimes it's not done right. And for sure, getting these cases to trial is far more important than I saw a guy get 28 years for a meth rock. Meanwhile, I've got two girls who are grown now on a 9-year-old case, and I can't get to trial. You know, and he's like asking for probation. I'm like, forget it. You know, so we really need to shift our priorities. And I'm going off on a tangent here into what I believe is like a child first agenda. You know, is there a child involved? Okay, that goes first. Was a child involved? That goes next. You know, is it acute or is it delayed? All right, then that's the next decisions. And that's how we prioritize which cases to get to trial. I'm not going to say that, you know, substance crimes don't matter at all, but FFS, they don't need to be taking up all the prison space and all the jury trial space, because it's going to take us a while to get where we need to be so that survivors can actually remove threats from the community. People forget these are the eyewitnesses to crimes. Like, these criminals are the most severe. And if the eyewitnesses cannot identify the criminal, if the criminal continues to deny it was him who committed the crime, there's only one thing to do, or else what? More people will be hurt. It is very simple math. For every day that a criminal remains free that has not been adjudicated, crimes will be committed. And so, that case really shook me up. And I'm still in touch with those girls. You know, I love them, you know, and what they survived was a great shame on me as a lawyer. And was one of those moments where you're like, you know, maybe I'll do a Sinead O'Connor and cut up my bar card on live TV because I'm so mad, you know, that my profession would allow this to happen in my state, in a county where my mother's buried, to two girls who had nothing. These were the girls that we should have protected the most. These were foster kids.
As somebody who has worked with clients that were either in the foster care system or they aged out of the foster care system and they became unhoused. They became, you know, they went to the streets, because after you hit a certain age, where the hell do you go? Right? And oftentimes they get mixed in and they get lumped into being forced into another system.
Those kids get trafficked.
Yes.
I have a real issue with aging out of systems, because our brains are not formed until we're 25. And that age range you're talking about, the Virginia Giuffre age range, that 16, 17, you know, it's hard to get people to care about those cases. The 7, 8, 9-year-olds, oh, they'll stomp their foot all day, but you bring them a 16-year-old and they're like, and so those girls are gonna get trafficked. It's yes. A feeder pattern. Trafficking always starts with being a victim first to someone else when you were younger, always.
And I know you're probably going to understand this as well as anybody else does, but a couple of weeks ago, I got alerted from somebody that I used to work with that one of our former clients went missing. I thought back to what I know about her story, what I know about her experience, and hearing her talk about what she has faced. And literally, like, at that time, she would have been close to 14 years old, and she's either like 18 or 19 now. Now, thinking about what she faced, and the other people that I worked with, they were like, oh, you know, she's very problematic, she's very hyper. And I said, y'all, if you went through, and not saying that you haven't, but, you know, we gotta be professional. We can't share like our own like personal experience with the clients, and, you know, there's boundaries and things like that. But I said, if you have been through what that girl has been through, not willingly, mind you, not willingly. She is a minor. I want to make that very clear. She is a child. I said, you would understand. I said, and until you do, and I hope to God that you never have to go through what that girl has gone through, or your child or your family member or whoever.
Yeah.
Because I hope you get told the exact same thing as what you just said about her. I said, that's not right. That's not fair. That's not right. Do not do that. Until you have been through it, do not inject your opinion into it, because it's not going to do anything. And all you're doing is perpetuating violence against somebody who literally cannot control that.
Right.
You know, this was her first taste of freedom, being in this shelter. This was her first taste of freedom. She can go around. She can talk to people. She can eat snacks. She can play games. She can watch TV. She never got to do that. She never got to see what it was like to be an actual fucking child. And majority of them don't, because they're locked in these homes, or they're sexually abused, or they're forced to do things that they don't want to fucking do. They're literally children. And until we address that, how can we say that we're advocates for children and we care about the children whenever we allow them to continue dying at the hands of somebody else, or they're taking their own life?
Yeah. I talk about this in the book. You know, a lot of this is survivors who have not said the truth about what's happened to them. Like Virginia Giuffre's mom, great example. This is her daughter in Epstein, and she knew it, but she wouldn't listen to her. Why? Because Virginia Giuffre was very convinced that her mother was a survivor. And I see this on jury panels all the time. Or, you know, I can't be on a jury because, you know, it happened to me when I was 5 and I've never told anyone until right this second. I mean, that has happened. And again, this goes back to the fear of disclosure being worse than the actual disclosure itself. It's like it is the monster under the bed. It is the biggest monster under every single bed. And until the survivor can free up that space inside themselves to witness, to listen, then you might get a lot of pushback from someone who actually has been through it. I mean, I know it's counterintuitive.
Uh-huh.
And that's the reality of it. And that's exactly. And if you would have saw the looks on my coworker's face whenever I was like, if you haven't been through it, go back into your office.
Yeah,
go back into where you are comfortable, because obviously you do not know how to talk to her. Go back to your training, first of all, because you have a certificate and you also have a degree in like the de-escalation and understanding. You're a victim advocate, dude. Like, wow. That's concerning.
Yeah, it does. And it seems unlikely that every person I've worked with in this field that's deep in it has been a survivor. Mm-hmm. It is surprising what you're telling me. I believe you, of course, but.
Which literally makes it that much more worth it to continue working within those systems,
but
also speaking up whenever you see something. Because I did report him, you know, mm-hmm. eventually he was removed, but he's done it for a very long time. He's done a very, very long time. And I won't mention, you know, obviously where that was or who this person is or et cetera.
Yeah.
I'll keep that obviously to myself, but they know.
Survivor shamer. I just came up with a new one. Survivor shamer. It's like perpetrator hater. I have these little monikers. Survivor shamer.
Yeah. Trademark.
Someone was like, do you hate men? I said, I'm not a man hater. I'm a perpetrator hater.
Oh, Jody, I have a story for you. So really quickly, we'll dive more into, you know, and this is what we do on this podcast. Like we do talk about some like very serious things, but we also like to have a little bit of fun. And I'm going to tell you a story. In high school, every time I tell this story, I think about my mom's face in this very moment. But I went to a doctor's appointment, or I think it was a psychologist, psychiatrist, something like that. And I was being put on like different medication, and you know, this was like a checkup, and we walked in, and you know, it's in like this like fancy little like office building, and we walk in, and you know, he's sitting at his desk, and or you know, we do like the whole check-in process, you know, all that stuff. We sit down, and he looks at me, he looks at my mom, he kind of took like a deep breath, and he's like, I figured out what I think is going on and how you're feeling. And I was like, I looked at my mom and I was like, okay. That's great to hear, you know, great. Let's talk about it. Right. And I can't help but laugh every single time I think about this, but he looks at me, he looks at my mom, and he was like, I think you have a fear of men. Before I could say anything, my mom looks at him with the blankest expression. And she said, that makes no goddamn sense. I said, Mom, she said, no. That makes no damn sense. You're gay. I was like, you gotta stop. And I had to walk out because I was like, I can't believe she just said that. And I was like he already knew that. He already knew. You know, yeah. he had no issue with that. But he was like, I think you have a fear of men. And I was like, and I grabbed my mom and I was like, don't say anything, don't say anything, don't say anything. And she like kind of like brushed me off, and she was like, that makes no goddamn sense. And I was like, Mom. We're at the doctor's office. She said, I don't give a damn. Where the hell did he get his degree from? And she just starts going off. And I tell this because it shows where a lot of like emotions come in whenever we're told things that we don't really want to be told. Come to find out, like, I understand not all men it's always a man.
Yeah.
And I've come to that conclusion. I'm not a man hater. I mean, my mom would say I am, but she's saying she is because of the shit that she's been through and the systems have completely failed her. But
why do we have to keep ignoring evidence? Okay. I had this conversation with myself, not to interrupt you, but
no, you're good. You're good. Yes.
With dating. I was like, why do I keep doing this to myself? And obviously I found the root of that problem. But then I figured out, okay, let me look at this from a trial lawyer standpoint. Where is there evidence? Okay. First of all, there's no evidence that there's a lid for every pot, that there's someone out there for everyone, that there's a soulmate. There's just not evidence for it. You might see some outliers. Great for them. I love that for them. You know, they kind of keep us all buying into this fantasy. But the fantasy is not supported by evidence. What is supported by evidence is that men, a human man has perpetrated crimes on me. How many times? And that doesn't even count crimes of the heart, the ghosting, the rejection, the bullshit, the, you know, lingering disrespect. And I'm like, that is evidence. So I'm under no obligation to ignore a tremendous weight of evidence and choose a fantasy instead. Like, we don't have to give them a benefit of the doubt. Like, it has not been earned.
Exactly. I think the older I get, the more bitter I get. Because I think back to my first sexual assault, which is at 17 years old. I'm walking into this police department and I have people that follow me and they, you know, know about my story and they've heard this podcast. I've talked about it a couple times, but walking into that police department and, you know, you're thinking, you know, your heart's going 1,000 beats a minute, your mind is rushing, you know, what are they going to say? What are they going to do? Am I going to get in trouble? Because it has happened numerous times. What was I met with? I was met with a judgmental desk officer that stated, were you not strong enough to fight him off? You're a man. Why were you not fighting him off? And my mom looked at me, and before I could say anything again, my mom's always been my biggest advocate. Anybody who knows her, you will know that she is a spitfire. She's a fireball. She also doesn't put up with any bullshit. She doesn't. And she never has, and she never will. Ask my stepfather about that. Well, you can't. Well, he's in Arizona somewhere, but who the hell knows? Anyway. they got divorced and I became sober from alcohol.
Yeah.
But long story short, you know, my mom pipes up and she was like, just serve and protect, right? Who the fuck are you serving and protecting whenever you don't believe survivors? And I was like, here we go. I was like, well, here we go. We're in a police station. You're going the fuck off on this desktop officer. We're going to get arrested because you just told this woman what she could do with her badge.
It was a woman who said that to you?
It was a woman. Yeah, she had like this long hair. She had glasses. She was kind of like, she just came across as just a real.
Wow. You remember her. You have.
And I swear I ran into her at a gas station, like in my hometown. Because my hometown, you know, I grew up in Independence, Missouri. So obviously home of Harry S. Truman, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Oh. And it's like a fairly progressive area. It is, you know, it's in Jackson County. It's like this, you know, vibrant community. People are great there. We have some great, you know, elected officials in that county and just across the state. There's incredible people and incredible organizers. Then you look at the police departments and you're like, this is a lot because this specific department did not have a special victims unit, like literally at all. And they also got rid of their funding for, you know, CIT officers, which I think is critical. Every department needs to have a CIT officer or an SOC.
What does that mean to you?
Crisis intervention. So they're the ones, you know, they have like a co-responder or like a social worker respond to like suicide, domestic violence, sexual assault, or whatever, or even like an overdose oftentimes.
I'm not so sure we have those here. Like, I didn't know that term.
I'm sure probably not in Texas, but sorry, I had to say that.
Oh, it's okay. You know, it runs the gamut. It runs the gamut between excellent with life sentences and 9-year-old cases. So,
yep. And there's not a fine line between
That's a problem.
You know, and there's not a fine line. It's not a one size fits all. It's like either we do great or we fuck up. And I mean, it's you can't win. And it's one of those damned if you do tell your stories and damned if you don't tell your story, because it's like, if you tell your story, you're not going to be believed. If you don't tell your story, you're not going to be believed. So it's like, what do you do? And a lot of people live with that for so long.
Yep.
You languish, you ruminate, and you, I mean, it never occurred to me that I could tell the truth about what happened to me to myself or to my, you know, to my therapist, and I wouldn't have to go to the police. I mean, I guess it did, but I made the choice. I was like, no, I'm not dealing with that. I got enough problems as it is. You know, I'm trying to be a high profile prosecutor here, and I know exactly what's going to happen, and it's going to tank my career. I knew that. I knew it. And so I just kept it to myself.
So speaking of that, you know, what is your thoughts on like restorative justice? So those alternatives to...
Oh, for sex offenders?
Just as a whole and as a concept.
For drugs, sure.
So I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on this.
No, I'm a huge, huge fan of diversion for drugs. Look, drugs is just people who are sexually abused trying to make it stop in their heads. I know that. So I'm a big fan of restorative justice for the right type of crime, not for sex offenders. Oh, no. I mean, I tend to say that it would be a very smart policy to divert drug crimes into restorative justice by and large, so that it's not even discretionary for the district attorneys. Because I see, you know, money being wasted on a meth rock. So I love restorative justice, but it doesn't work for sex offenders. I cannot change someone's deviant arousal, okay? If someone, you know, finds delight, pleasure in a child's body, there's nothing I can do to fix that. There's nothing anyone can do to fix that. There is no science to support that. And since there's no way to fix it, how is that person ever allowed back in society? So I don't believe in it. And frankly, I don't even like probation.
I've seen both sides of the argument, whatever it comes to restorative justice and like how effective it can be, but also how ineffective. And there's some pros and there's some cons to both sides of it, right? And I think it's another one of those things that it's not a one size fits all. I think it works in some spaces. It doesn't work in other spaces. You know, there's a really good organization that's called Survivors for Justice Reform and focuses a lot on transformational justice and restorative justice. And I worked alongside some of the other advocates and survivors that are a part of that. And thinking about it, and I'm very new to like the subject and I'm very new to understanding it a little bit. And I see it in other countries like Canada, and I see it in like Australia and like the UK. They utilize different aspects of it in different ways.
For abusers?
But then I think about the United States and how our systems function, how our systems are. And I'm like, in an ideal world, we wouldn't even need that, right? We wouldn't even need to go to court. We wouldn't even need to go to police. We wouldn't even need to go anywhere else. But I just, it's a controversial topic. It is. And I get tongue twisted because I can't really like, I don't know. I don't know how to explain
I'll help you work through it.
I think it's just that
sex offenders are the most manipulative criminal population that there is. Like, they're so manipulative that there's a special kind of therapist called a licensed sex offender treatment provider. Have you ever heard of this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So like, maybe if we could train an army of LSOTPs to run restorative justice for certain types of sex offenders, like, I know that it can be helpful for juveniles. I know that juvenile LSOTPs and juvenile, you know, treatment programs can be very effective. So that, you know, that's where if we were going to do restorative justice, I would target it at the juvenile population and to training a whole lot of LSOTPs. And, you know, because they need to know that if someone's being accused of this particular type of crime, this is not a regular person that you're treating, right? This is someone who has advanced manipulation skills, and someone with advanced manipulation skills, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, you know, with therapists and lawyers. I mean, people that don't know are very easily manipulated. That's just the facts. And so, you know, if there were some safeguards and some parameters, because look, there's so many perpetrators out there right now. I don't know what we're going to do. We don't have enough prisons. If a plan that I came up with were to be implemented, you know, we would have a lot. We would still be needing places to put people, and we would still need programs. And, you know, maybe for the internet guys, some restorative justice, you know, I don't know. But dealing with these perpetrators and getting the most dangerous ones out of the street so they can't hurt our kids is number one.
Whenever I think about restorative practices, I think about somebody like Ted Bundy, right? Or somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, or somebody like BTK, or I don't know why I always resort to these serial perpetrators, but it's definitely...
Well, it's the thing.
I think about it, and I think about, like, can they truly be a hunt? You can't restore evil. And I'm going to be the first one to say, you can't restore evil. There is no restoring it. And I understand different perspectives, I understand different views, and I'm willing to sit down and learn, right? Yeah. But I also think about the structure of how our systems are currently designed and how they were designed, and they're working exactly how they were designed. They're working by design.
Yeah, yeah. And no, they're perpetrator favors.
I can't imagine. Yeah. I cannot imagine a world where Ted Bundy would be able to be rehabilitated. I don't see it. I cannot vision it, nor do I want to, because that does an injustice to the people that he murdered and the people that he raped and the people that, you know,
No, it's got to stop. Someone has to put their foot down.
And there's such a fine line of understanding, like, as somebody who grew up on true crime and listening to true crime and listening to true crime podcasts and watching true crime on TV, you know, my grandmother was obsessed with it. My mom is obsessed with it. And it's like a generational thing to be obsessed with true crime. I'm almost certain that it's literally just generational. Like, my grandma grew up on it. You know, she loves it. I'm growing up, you know, I grew up on it. And I'm not talking about, like, SVU. I'm talking about, like, some, like, actual, like, freaking true crime. Now, I can watch it on TV, but I also have to make sure that every single window is locked, make sure every single door is locked. And if I hear one little sound, I jump. And like I said, I can listen to the most intense story, but if I see it in person, I freeze instantly. I freeze, I shut down, because it's like, okay, shit's getting too real. I can also sit here and I can watch horror films. Again, I grew up on horror. I love horror films. My mom does not, unless it's like, you know, Michael Myers and Freddy or, you know, something like that. But I'm more into, like, the paranormal, you know, like The Conjuring, because it is based off of true stories. And again, I think if I saw a ghost in person, you got to make sure there's a defibrillator around, because I don't know what's going to happen. And or make sure there's a toilet around, because, well, stuff is going to happen. I just don't know what the hell it's going to be. But it's the reality.
I mean, that's Survivor, you know, that's your amygdala.
It is.
That's the same being frozen as being frozen from saying the truth about what's happened to you. It is literally your brain frozen.
I learned a new term earlier this year, and I realized that what happened to me during my sexual assaults was I fawned.
Yeah.
So there's fight, there's flight, there's freeze, mm-hmm. and there's fawn. And there's also, like, another one too, and I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I've done that before.
But apparently I fawned. And I was like, what the fuck is that? Yeah. But it's kind of like you leave your body for a second, you know, it's like you're looking at it like.
That's dissociation is what we call it.
It's like.
Feel dissociation.
You just see it. Yeah. And I feel like I disassociated with, like, everything that was going on.
Yeah.
And I was like, this makes entire sense. It makes entire sense now.
Yep. That is a very real. In fact, I kind of have a joke, like, for very, you know, advanced survivors. I'm like, make your trauma work for you. You know, if you're in an uncomfortable conversation with someone, you know, use your disassociation, because now I have control over it, you know, like, kind of, you know, deer in the headlights. But yeah, I've actually had disassociation where I disassociated from my disassociated self. Like, I saw my disassociated self from a fourth. Yeah, that was the last time it happened to me. And that was the time I was like, what is this? I cannot keep running from this, because I was sober. You know, he's, you know, a high credentialed perpetrator. Like, I thought I did everything right, and here I was again. And that's when I got real serious about figuring this out.
So you wrote this book, and it comes out in April of 2026. Now, how do you feel now that it's in the book? You know, people are going to read this, people are going to see it. There's also going to be those people that are be like, they're going to critique the hell out of it, right? Because they do with every survivor story. I see on social media, you know, you mentioned about Virginia earlier.
Yeah.
And she wrote that book, and I'm seeing people's comments that are absolutely disgusting.
I know.
If there's anything that I've come to realize, it's don't read the comments.
know.
Because those comments, they're going to piss you off. And literally, you're just arguing with internet trolls online. And you stay up until 4 o'clock in the morning arguing with this robotic account. And, you know, they're giving you all of these things. I've come to realize, like, yeah, there's often times that I want to respond to, but I also pull myself back and I'm like, it's not going to do anything. It's going to raise my blood pressure. I'm not going to sleep tonight because I'm going to have this person's comment in my head. And like, it's giving them the satisfaction of what they're looking for. And 9 times out of 10, they're not an actual person anyway. It's literally an AI generated account, or, you know, it's like, there are ways that. And I sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but and I'm
no,
not.
I believe you.
But
I believe you. That makes it make a lot more sense.
And like thinking about how like social media companies like to infiltrate and do some stupid shit anyway, and thinking about it, you know, Meta is notorious for allowing, you know, during the Charlie Kirk assassination, that video like went around social media very heavily. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly triggering. It was incredibly, and people were just sharing it like left and right. And, you know, like, while I don't support what happened to Charlie Kirk, I did not like him. I did not idolize him, nothing like that. I still don't support the political violence because it's not right on any case. It's not. However, while I don't support what happened to Charlie Kirk had a very strong opinion about what happened to Charlie Kirk. And that's the reality of that, but I'm gonna leave it at that. But, you know, thinking about it being in this book now, and thinking about, you know, people in general, because people in general are just disgusting. And here's the thing, I will fight like hell for the right to be disgusting. I'll sit here and I'll say, like, you know, yeah, free speech, free speech, free speech. Even if I don't agree with it, they still do have the right to free speech, because free speech is for everybody. There does come a fine line of whenever it comes down to threatening speech.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that. They're like, oh, you know, and we'll receive DMs like, oh, I'm going to come murder your children. Well, lucky for you, only thing I fucking have is a poodle. So come at me, bro. Like, but I think about that, and receiving, you know, survivors, just a couple of days ago, the Epstein survivors put out a letter that they have been receiving death threats.
Yeah. I know what you're asking. And to answer your question, that you haven't asked, but I know you're asking. I got myself off the CAD. In Texas, our addresses are listed publicly on the Central Appraisal District's website. Mm-hmm. And I sold all my real estate and moved into a secure tower. And I hardly ever leave my house. And I'm really just as safe as I can be right now, because I know I'm picking a fight with every perpetrator on the planet. I am giving everyone the tools that Virginia Giuffre did not have, nor did I have, so that we can identify perpetrators if we choose to. And at minimum, we can just live real lives, not like traumatize people all the time. Like, that's not life. You know, living with that kind of pain, it affects everything. And so, yeah, I took a lot of measures to get myself safe. And I was safe before I turned in my manuscript, because it's not lost on me what I'm up against. And it's cost me a lot, this book. And just like any situation where a woman has to take care of herself, oh, she's crazy. Like, no, I'm not crazy. I'm correct. And I know what's going into my book. And I know who's out there, because I'm actually living in the world and, you know, not hiding from it.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that takes, because you know what's best for you.
Yeah.
You did it.
A ball game when you got babies, too. You can't take chances.
Absolutely. I admire that about you. If there's anything that I know, you know, in the couple times that we've talked, and, you know, just on social media, and, you know, uplifting us and to be up with you, and my, you know, and there's obviously those collaborative spaces that are continue to happen. And I'm looking forward to sitting down and reading this. And obviously we'll do another episode about how you feel now that, you know, we'll kind of like walk through the book, and I'll, you know, things like that. So we'll do another one. We'll do a follow-up next year after this book releases, because I'm excited to see what is going to come from this. And I know there's going to be a lot more coming. And speaking of that, you know, now that this book is coming out, what is also next for you, and how can people connect with you and continue to uplift your work, and how can they follow you on social media?
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I have a link tree. The link is in my bio. I post a lot of videos on TikTok. I would love your help. If you follow me on Instagram, follow me on TikTok. I'm really trying to get my metrics up to get the book out. I mean, this book has to be read by millions and millions, billions of people, really. And so I need so much help. And it's not just because I want to sell books. Look, I could make a very nice living as a lawyer. It's because the books, the message has got to get out there. So I have a link tree. I'm on TikTok, Jody Neal Attorney. My website, jodyneal.com. I have a law firm website, neilnowlegal.com. And I do take consults for clients, but that's, I'm really focusing on my book right now. And I am starting a second book. And it's going to be really about the way mothers are treated by many different systems, including healthcare, family courts. That's the plan anyway. So I'm meeting with my collaborator next week, and hopefully we'll have something to pitch to my publisher very soon.
That is incredible. And it's going to continue on and on and on. I love it. And you're talking about topics that are not talked on nearly enough, like literally at all. And it's not. And if there's anything about the systems, is they're all connected and they're all intertwined. And realizing the intersectionality of all of it, I think, is where a lot of the change really come in.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want to say thank you again for coming on the podcast and for doing, you know, this work that does oftentimes become very thankless. You know, it's kind of like being a nurse and kind of like being, you know, these very thankless positions. So I want to say thank you, you know, again, for being candid and having this conversation. And I think it's really going to be eye-opening for a lot of people to understand your perspective. And, you know, with that, again, thank you for coming on the podcast. Please take care of yourself and we will see you around very soon.
Thank you so much for having me. And God bless you for the work that you do. Truly, God bless you.
Thank you. I appreciate you.